Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Veru Inc.'s Investors Conference Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After this morning's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note that this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. Sam Fisch, Veru Inc.'s Executive Director of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications. Please go ahead.
Good morning. The statements made on this conference call may be forward-looking statements. Forward-looking statements may include, but are not necessarily limited to, statements of the company's plans, objectives, expectations, or intentions regarding its business, operations, finances, and development and product portfolio. Such forward-looking statements are subject to known and unknown risks and uncertainties, and our actual results may differ significantly from those projected, suggested, or included in any forward-looking statements. Risks that may cause actual results or developments to differ materially are contained in our 10-Q and 10-K SEC filings, as well as in our press releases from time to time. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Dr. Mitchell Steiner, Veru Inc.'s Chairman, CEO, and President.
Good morning. With me on this morning's call are Michelle Greco, CFO and CAO, Dr. Gary Barnett, Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. Domingo Rodriguez, EVP Global Clinical Operations, Dr. Gary Bird, EVP Quality and Regulatory Affairs, Dr. Harry Fish, Vice Chairman and Chief Corporate Officer, Michael Purvis, EVP General Counsel and Corporate Strategy, and Sam Fish, Executive Director of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications. Thank you for joining our call. Veru is dedicated to the development of novel medicines for the management of the two most prevalent cancers, breast cancer and prostate cancer. One of our anti-cancer drugs, sabizabulin, has dual antiviral and anti-inflammatory effects, so it was also being developed for the treatment of hospitalized, moderate to severe COVID-19 patients at high risk for acute respiratory distress syndrome and death, which remains a global, dire, unmet medical need. This morning, we announced that the Independent Data Monitoring Committee has conducted a planned interim analysis of our Phase 3 COVID-19 clinical trial and unanimously recommended early stopping of the study because of evidence of overwhelming positive efficacy. Sabizabulin disrupts intracellular transport of the coronavirus as the long microtubules. This is a highly conserved biological process that is required by all variants of COVID-19, including Omicron, to cause infection. While there have been recent developments evaluating, including the Merck drug, Molnupiravir, and the Pfizer drug Paxlovid for the treatment of unhospitalized patients with COVID-19 who had a relatively lower risk of dying, sabizabulin, in contrast, is being developed for hospitalized moderate to severe COVID-19 patients who are at high risk for ARDS and death, patients for whom there are currently no clearly effective treatment, and a population in which the Merck drug Molnupiravir did not demonstrate efficacy. Based on our positive Phase 2 clinical study in hospitalized moderate to severe COVID-19 patients at high risk for acute respiratory distress syndrome that showed that sabizabulin treatment resulted in a significant reduction in deaths compared to placebo, we conducted a Phase 3 COVID-19 clinical trial, which is a double-blind, multi-center, multinational, randomized 2-to-1 placebo-controlled study evaluating daily oral 9-milligram dose of sabizabulin for up to 21 days versus placebo in approximately 210 hospitalized moderate to severe COVID-19 patients who had high risk for acute respiratory distress syndrome and death. Both the placebo and sabizabulin-treated groups were allowed to receive standard of care, which could include dexamethasone, remdesivir, anti-IL-6 receptor antibodies, and JAK inhibitors. Moderate to severe COVID-19 symptoms means patients that are hospitalized, which means WHO criteria greater than or equal to 4, and require supplemental oxygen up to mechanical ventilation of ECMO or ECMO. Furthermore, one of the inclusion criteria is the patient must have a peripheral capillary oxygen saturation of less than or equal to 94% on room air. This is a very sick patient population at high risk for ARDS and death. The pre-specified primary efficacy endpoint is the proportion of patients who die on study up to day 60. Secondary endpoints include the proportion of patients without respiratory failure, days in the ICU, WHO ordinal scale for clinical improvement change from baseline, days on mechanical ventilation, days in the hospital, and viral load. The study was conducted in the U.S., Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, and Bulgaria, and COVID-19 infections in the study included the Delta and Omicron variants. In January, the FDA granted fast-track designation to the Phase 3 COVID-19 registration program. Fast-track designation aims to expedite the development and review of new drugs that are intended to treat serious or life-threatening conditions and demonstrate the potential to fill unmet medical needs. Filling an unmet medical need is defined as providing a therapy when none exists or providing a therapy which may potentially be better than available therapy. Thus, having fast-track designation is a distinction that underscores the urgent need for new, novel, and effective therapies to use along with vaccinations to combat this COVID-19 pandemic. On April 8, 2022, the Independent Data Monitoring Committee conducted a planned interim efficacy analysis in the first 150 subjects enrolled in the Phase 3 COVID-19 study. After reviewing the unblinded clinical data, the Independent Data Safety Monitoring Committee unanimously recommended that the Phase 3 study be halted early due to overwhelmingly positive efficacy. They also remarked that no safety concerns were identified. The pre-specified primary endpoint was death at or before day 60. Sabizabulin treatment resulted in a clinically and statistically meaningful 55% relative reduction in death with a p-value of 0.0029 in the intent-to-treat population. The placebo group with N of 52 had a 45% mortality rate compared to a 20% mortality rate in the sabizabulin-treated group, N equals 98. The placebo group rate of 45%, placebo group death rate of 45%, underscores how sick these patients really are. The poor outcomes demonstrates the inadequacy of the current standard of care, which could have included dexamethasone, remdesivir, and anti-IL-6 receptor antibodies and JAK inhibitors. Again, the addition of sabizabulin reduced deaths by 55% in this critically ill population. The secondary efficacy endpoints are still being analyzed at this time. Sabizabulin treatment was well tolerated in this patient population with no clinically relevant safety observations in the sabizabulin-treated group compared to placebo. The company plans to meet with FDA to discuss next steps, including the submission of the emergency use authorization application. We will also begin to plan for regulatory submissions outside the United States. The company has scaled up manufacturing processes to produce commercial drug supply to address anticipated drug needs following any potential FDA authorization. We have been in discussions with BARDA and other U.S. government agencies in an effort to secure an advanced purchase agreement of drug product for the U.S. COVID-19 global cases, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to be high. New variants of COVID-19 are brewing. COVID-19 surges will happen. New York and Washington, D.C. have seen a doubling of new cases of COVID-19. Vaccines are not enough. Some of the antibody drugs are not effective against the Omicron variant BA1 or BA2. COVID-19 is surpassing 2 years as a pandemic and does not appear to be going away. It is clear that an effective and safe oral therapeutic that prevents deaths in hospitalized patients with moderate to severe COVID-19 infection who at high risk for ARDS and death is desperately needed. We strongly believe that sabizabulin, with its dual antiviral and anti-inflammatory properties, and with these Phase 3 efficacy and safety results, can be that greatly needed oral therapy for hospitalized patients with moderate to severe COVID-19 as a new standard of care. We will continue to update you on the regulatory progress towards the emergency use authorization, manufacturing, additional clinical data releases and publications, BARDA discussions, our U.S. and global distribution plans, and our partnership discussions. We're committed to driving shareholder value by developing and commercializing novel medicines addressing significant unmet medical needs, and with a positive Phase 3 study, we will advance to seek regulatory approvals and a commercialization of sabizabulin 9 milligrams for hospitalized moderate to severe COVID-19 patients with high risk of acute respiratory distress syndrome and death. Sabizabulin has the potential to satisfy an important unmet medical need and to become a new tool against moderate to severe COVID-19 and potentially for other serious viruses that utilize microtubules to cause infection and death, including influenza virus, Ebola virus, and many others. Finally, I would like to say I'm so proud of our team that has stepped up to the challenge. We were duty-bound, we fought, and we succeeded. I would like to thank Dr. Gary Barnett, Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. Domingo Rodriguez, the EVP of Global Clinical Operations, Dr. Gary Bird, EVP of Quality and Regulatory Affairs, Amy O'Brien, the Senior Manager, Clinical Operations, responsible for the Phase 3 clinical study, Chris Hitchens, Denise Padavina, Johanna Sanchez-Adams, Sandria Elrod Ekbal, Adam Mann, Worldwide Clinical Trials, Argus Research, CoreRx, and Olan Reserca. I would also like to thank all those folks at Veru that supported the effort. With that, I'll now open the call to questions. Operator?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that you please pick up your handset before pressing the keys to ensure the best sound quality. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. If you have further questions, you may re-enter the question queue. Once again, that is star, then one to rejoin the question queue. We will pause momentarily to assemble our roster. Our first question comes from Leland Gershell from Oppenheimer. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My congratulations on this terrific data and much needed. Wanted to ask a couple questions. First, Mitch, could you comment on how long on average patients were on sabizabulin? And also wanted to ask if you could just kind of walk us through the emergency use timelines, FDA meeting and thereafter, when could we see the availability of this drug? Thank you.
Sure. So as you know, we just got the data on Friday, so we're still capturing it all. I can tell you in the phase two study, it was about 10 days on average, and we think it's going to be similar in this study. So it shows you how potent this agent is, that even though the patients could be on it for 21 days, with 10 days on average, we were able to see this dramatic effect. As it relates to your second question again, I will tell you, since we have fast track designation, we have been in constant dialogue with FDA. And so what we're doing now is we're pulling together the documentation that we need to have the first formal interaction with the FDA. And so, hopefully that'll happen, this month. And then, I'd say a different way, it will happen this month. and then at that point, we're going to get to work to get this EUA application in. And the timing is depending on the FDA. As you know, an EUA application is not the same thing as an NDA, where you have, PDUFA dates and all that stuff. So they can be pretty short about it. They can take their time. But, again, in a patient population where for the last 2 years nothing has really stepped up for a disease like COVID-19 that's probably the number one threat in the world, and the threat is the people that are dying, and this is the space that we're in. If you look at the CDC guidelines, it's remdesivir and dexamethasone. That's it for 2 years. So this really represents a big step forward. And I'm hoping that will be reflected in the speed in which the FDA evaluates the EUA.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Brandon Folkes from Cantor Fitzgerald. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my questions and congratulations on the data. Maybe just firstly, at this stage, can you elaborate potentially on any difference in the two treatment arms and placebo arms on potentially different standard of cares used in those arms? Was it pretty balanced across the arms? Just trying to parse out if there's sort of any difference in standard of care there?
Yeah, to answer your question, we did get that data. So even though it was the first look, so there are no imbalances with males and females, and with standard of care is exactly, I mean, the system worked, so the randomization worked, so there are no imbalances.
Oh, fantastic. And then maybe just follow up on your comment on the manufacturing capacity. You talked about, you know, that you have scaled up. Are you looking to partner this, just given how big it could be?
It's a great question.
Getting up at manufacturing, what is that address, maybe, just given how large the potential could be?
Yeah. Well, so again, we're very fortunate that unlike some of these other agents, it's a 9-milligram dose once a day. That's it. You're not talking about, you know, a handful of pills every day and taking pills to knock out peak glycoprotein and all that stuff. It's one pill a day. It's a capsule. And so the capsule can be opened up and put through an NG tube for somebody that's in the ICU, or they can take it orally if they can. And so, and it doesn't require cold storage, and it's not an IV. So as you, and I'm going through this because part of manufacturing is all of the controls and the ways that you have to treat the material to get it from, you know, point A to point B. So without the cold storage, I mean, you can put, you know, I mean, I exaggerate the point to make the point, you can put it on backpacks and get it to areas of the world that can't get it. And it's a pill, so you don't have to give an IV, and it doesn't require cold storage and the whole bit. So from that standpoint, it's really a simple small molecule. And so since it's a simple small molecule, then the manufacturing process is pretty straightforward. I believe it takes about five steps to make the drug. We have been incredibly robust in our manufacturing practices, and so we are in place to scale up to meet the world's demand, and we've been, as I mentioned, Olan Resirca is helping us with helping us with the API. And CoreRx is helping us with the capsules. Both the Olan Resirca and CoreRx will be U.S.-based, and so that we can control in the U.S. manufacturing of our products. So we're not looking for API coming from China, India. It will be U.S. And so from that standpoint, it is not as overwhelming as you think. I think the manufacturing part of it is the easiest part. The second, and we can do that, and we've done that, and it's in place. The next part is distribution, and I think the most important thing about distribution is that this is hospital-based. This is not getting a doctor in a practice to write a prescription and sending a patient to a pharmacy. This is a patient that's hospitalized, on oxygen, going down the slippery slope. So the hospital formularies is where this drug will be. As you know, hospital formulary distribution is pretty standard, and once you've plugged into their GPOs and all that stuff and you're on their formularies, they just order it from the chart. And so the patient's in the ICU, and this is part of a standard of care algorithm, then it'll be part of the standard of care algorithm filled automatically in each of the hospitals. Hospital filling and distribution is very different than trying to get every pharmacy to have it stocked. And so it's a much smaller number, much more manageable number. It doesn't require a sales force, a few account managers to follow up. Now, with that said, yes, it is big. This is the biggest threat in the world right now. It's COVID-19. It's not only a threat to life, but it's crippling economies. It's been kind of, as much as we want to wish it to go away, it just feels like it's not going away. Even China, where COVID-19 originated, is shutting down again in big blocks, and because even with the most drastic public health policies, they can't get it under control. And so with that said, we're going to do everything in our power to keep moving things. It's doable for us to move it, but it makes a lot of sense to partner where it makes sense or more. So that we can make sure that this drug, gets to every place in the world that it can get to, and that we get through the regulatory processes of the U.S. and outside the U.S. As efficiently and quickly as possible, and this is where hopefully government will step in, and for every one of these drugs that have come out, the Merck drug, the Pfizer drug, the vaccines. BARDA and other government agencies have stepped up with an advanced purchase order agreement, and we're looking forward to the same thing because this is the one that actually is its endpoint is death, not hospitalizations, days in the hospital, ICU days. It's death. You can't fake a death, and so the efficacy is highly effective and more effective than what appears to be out there now today. So we're up for the challenge, and we're going to push hard. But partnerships along the way, whether it's regional or global, is just another way to get this important drug to patients.
Great. Thanks so much, Mitch, and congratulations to you and the team.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Chris Howerton from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Great. I will also offer my congratulations. Really much needed, absolutely. So I guess in addition to what's already been asked, Mitch, can you help us understand what the kind of revenue stream would look like? I think at the beginning of the call you mentioned that you're in negotiations with BARDA around a supply agreement. Would that be the primary avenue for revenues, or would there be opportunities to negotiate directly with hospitals and providers? And just a little more understanding on what that opportunity would look like would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. So the way to think of it is, the government pre-orders, but that's not that's scratching the surface. The revenue stream will be coming directly from hospitals and ICUs across the country and across the world. And so when you think of the government, the way I would think of governments right now is two things. One is they're going to prime the pump, and so maybe $2.5 billion plus or more, because you're dealing with different pharmacoeconomics here. This is not treating somebody who's got some symptoms of COVID-19 and treating thousands of patients to go from 14% to 7% reduction in deaths and hospitalizations. This is reduction of deaths in patients in the ICUs and in hospitals that are requiring tremendous resources to keep them alive. And unfortunately, half of them will go on to die anyway. And that's what's overwhelming the system, and that's what's costing the most money, and that's where we're going. And so if we can reduce that by 55%, then you can see that the revenue should be significant, and $2.5 billion, you're really just scratching the surface in terms of that. Now, with that said, the expectation is that governments will, in addition to priming the pump, so to speak, to get into hospitals and to start dealing with the pandemic, the most important part, which is the part that's missing, which is to save people from dying, is that have already gone down that path of slippery slope, is stockpiling. So our expectation is that we don't want to be caught when COVID-23 and COVID-24 and COVID-25 come along, and we know there are at least two additional strains that are brewing out there right now that we're trying to understand. We're still trying to get our arms around BA2, and I heard this morning 29 states have already reported an increase in COVID-19, so it's coming back, another surge. So with that said, stockpiling so that they're ready for the next epidemic is probably going to be another piece of the revenue that we can count on for our company. So this is just, as I mentioned in my opening comments, this is a singularly biggest threat to the world right now, and we've come up with an agent that's an antiviral, anti-inflammatory that deals with patients that have a viral issue and the concomitant triggered inflammatory issue that leads to the demise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to that point, Mitch, maybe just to put a bow on that, what level of long-term stability do you have on sabizabulin right now? And I know you said you want me to hop back in the queue, but I'll just ask it anyway, which is, does this change any of your plans in terms of sabizabulin development in oncology? I'm just trying to think if there's any sequelae for pricing or exposure or anything else that we should consider down the line. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. So where we are at stability right now is we're at 12 months. I think that'll get you a two-year expiry or something like that. That's typically what you have to provide. So we'll be good with that. And I can tell you the stability of sabizabulin is such that, you know, we'd be very surprised ultimately we can't get 5 years. But right now, I would think the launch of the product would be around two. As it relates to your question about affecting the other programs, you know, fortunately, we have a really, you know, we've done a great job pulling together a great team to stay on top of the clinical trials in oncology. And as you know, we have robust prostate cancer and robust breast cancer programs. And so we're going to continue, those are going to continue as planned. And so we're not expecting any changes there. There's no question that this is a big, monumental next step for our company. But again, as I said in my comments, we're up for the task. We will do what we need to do. We are very fortunate that we're still incredibly well capitalized. As I mentioned in previous calls, at the last public information from our last quarter ending, so it would be the the money on hand is about $116 million in the bank, and we've got a product and soon products that are generating revenue. So we're fine. And so a lot of what we're going to be doing right now is the resources are going to be regulatory resources and, you know, manufacturing resources. And that's not expensive. We're not running clinical trials for, additional clinical trials, large clinical trials in cancer. And then we're set. And so all that's in the budget. So with that said, I think we're in good shape. So the impact is, yes, we're going to be highly focused in getting this drug, getting sabizabulin to market, but we're not going to take our eye off the ball on the oncology products that are in late-stage clinical development.
Okay, that's very clear, and I appreciate your time, and congratulations again.
Thank you, Chris.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one. And to withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Our next question comes from Kumar Raja from Brookline Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my questions, and also congratulations on the data. So with regard to the age of the patients, what can you share in regards to patients who are 65 and older? And also with regard to the stratification data, Delta versus Omicron and age and country, when do you think that would be available?
Actually, I'm going to ask Dr. Gary Barnett to answer that question.
Yeah, so we just have some analyses. We haven't obviously gotten all the data yet. However, the age is equally distributed across the two treatment groups. The mean and standard deviation are identical. The average age in the study was in the low 60s. and as far as stratification, we have equal balance of all the WHO scores, 4, 5, 6, et cetera. We also have an equal balance, as Mitch mentioned, in standard of care across the treatment groups. And as far as Omicron and Delta and what variant, we know that patients in both groups in the study had Omicron and Delta. We've not done any analysis on how those two broke out between the two treatment groups. However, in this type of study, you would expect it to be fairly similar between the treatment groups.
Right. So as I mentioned in my comment, no imbalances, and also the p-value that we announced in the interim takes into account all of the information you just asked about.
That's right.
That's great. And also, what are your thoughts on, potentially exploring the drug in early infection so as to prevent hospitalization? Are you guys thinking about it, or you think this should be good enough?
Let's make sure I understand the question. You're using it in other patient populations?
Earlier,
yes. So I'm going to answer it two ways. The first thing is we got a plateful getting this thing out in the area that has the greatest need, which is, patients that are dying in the hospital. And that's the part that scares everybody, because that's going to lag the incidence. As the incidence goes up, and then you get your hospitalizations, then you get your deaths. and it just keeps happening. And when you look at the number of deaths, you know, approaching 500,000 and 600,000 in the U.S., it scares you, okay? Because, you know, that's unbelievable. And we're sitting around saying, well, maybe we should just drop our masks because that's okay. And so anyway, I would say to you that if we can get into the hospitalized space, moderate, severe COVID-19, we'd make a major change in the battle that's ahead of us. Now, with that said, the science, the mechanism of the drug is that it's both an antiviral and anti-inflammatory agent, and we're using it in cancer patients at very high doses, and I can tell you that the safety looks very good. And in this patient population, you'll see the safety data eventually, and I think you're going to be incredibly surprised how well it's tolerated. And with that said, because it's so well tolerated, you can go earlier. And, and could this be a standard of care for, prevention or something of that nature when somebody thinks they've been exposed and you're not having to take 40 pills with, peak glycoprotein inhibitors like ritonavir and all that stuff. One pill a day or even maybe a lower dose is possible. But again, our focus is our primary focus is to get this indication across the finish line.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ronnie Rabin from the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Some of my questions were answered, but just to clarify, so these results are from a randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial. And if you could say anything more about the mechanism of the drug, how it works.
Sure. Happy to. And so, and thank you for calling in. The mechanism of the drug is that it is a small molecule that binds to microtubules. Microtubules are a structure in cells that are responsible for transporting whether they're viruses or receptors in the cell. So cells are like a bag of soup where things just floating around where it wants to go. It's highly structured, and the network, the trafficking that occurs in the cell and the highways that cause that trafficking to occur is the microtubules. So when a virus infects a cell, it binds to the microtubule and is actually brought on that railroad track, if you want to call it that, into the nucleus where it divides into more viruses. And then the viruses can't just float out. They have to get back on that track and get and make their way back to the outside of the cell where it gets liberated to infect additional cells. So the reason why we're not variant dependent is because that's such a critical process for a virus to get into a cell, get replicated, and go back out, that if they had a mutation that wouldn't let them stick onto the highway, they couldn't infect. And so whether you have a blue bus, a red bus, your car, if you use the highway, you're going to be affected. And we see that. I mean, Omicron or the Delta variant, it just doesn't matter. And that's why we feel that we have almost like a broad spectrum antibiotic concept. It's a broad spectrum antiviral because it's not so specific like an antibody where, as soon as a virus mutates, the antibody doesn't work. This is pretty broad. So the mechanism is it disrupts these highways and breaks them down so that the virus can't get from point A to point B. And that same mechanism is how the cell causes the cytokine storm. So the cytokine storm is, a bunch of bags filled with inflammatory proteins that the cell has to push outside the cell. And the way it does that is it puts these vacuoles onto the highway, the microtubules, and releases them into the outside the cell to create inflammation. And so what our compound does by disrupting the microtubules, it also makes it such that the cytokines can't get liberated. That's why it's an anti-inflammatory, antiviral, same mechanism. It disrupts the microtubules, the highway, so things can't get in, things can't get out.
And to follow up your first question, yes, this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study conducted in accordance with current GCPs.
Thank you so much. Great explanation. Thanks.
The next question comes from Max Baer from Fierce Biotech. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, all. Thank you for taking my question. You mentioned that some of this interim analysis covers both the Delta and Omicron periods. I'm wondering if you have any top-line efficacy differences based off of those variants. And I was also wondering if among the patient population, you had any data on the percent or the number of patients that were immunocompromised and if there are any differences among those patients. Thank you.
Okay, Gary.
Yeah, this is Gary. We don't have the data right now, top-line data on anything related to the proportion of or what happened in the various variants. We just don't have that yet. We will analyze that as we go forward. As far as so basically, that is part of the analysis of the data that would be going forward. But right now, we know that Omicron and Delta both were included in the study.
Well, as it relates to immunocompromised patients, again, we are not seeing any groups of patients that are imbalanced between the treated and the untreated. So we're not seeing that, not seeing males, females. It all was very, very balanced. So the randomization process looked like it went well, and all of those potential differences were accounted for and looked at in the top line data. So we feel pretty good, and the independent data monitoring committee also voted unanimously that after they reviewed the data that moving forward is just unethical. I mean, we saw an overwhelming efficacy, so they stopped the study, and they looked at that same kinds of data that you're mentioning now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our question and answer session. I would like to turn the conference call back over to Dr. Mitchell Steiner for any closing remarks.
Thank you. I appreciate all of you joining us on today's call. I look forward to updating you on all our progress. I will tell you that COVID-19 remains the biggest single threat to the world right now. Across the board, we're 2 years into the pandemic. Sabizabulin has emerged as a drug that can go right into the hospitalized world where patients, that's where patients are dying and make a difference. And it's a new chemical entity, it's not a repurposed drug. And so we're looking forward to moving that across the finish line. And this positive phase 3 data is a transforming event for Veru in our fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. So thank you for joining us today.
The digital replay of the conference call will be available beginning approximately noon Eastern Time today, April 11th, by dialing 1-877-344-7529 in the U.S. and 1-412-317-0088 internationally. You will be prompted to enter the replay access code, which will be 582-0166. Please record your name and company when joining. The conference call has now concluded. Thank you for attending today's discussion.